Last week, we began a new series, a series in the seven deadly sins, a series that will take us through the season of Lent all the way up to Easter morning. And we began last week with, well, I'll use the old name, the sin of acedia, the sin of acedia. Now, we don't really use that word anymore. It became the word sloth, but we didn't use that word because for most of us, I think, we hear sloth and we think laziness. But the truth is that's not really what acedia is all about. Acedia is an inertia. It is a disinclination to act, but not on everything. That's laziness, but in particular, the things of God. Some have described acedia as the sin of the age, as something of a metaphysical boredom. That is, we are no longer interested or concerned with the things that God says are right and good and will bring life. In fact, when we hear about things like a deep life of prayer, study of the scriptures, practice of spiritual disciplines, many people today inwardly groan and say, ugh. That sounds so boring. It sounds so tedious. Acedia is often seen in people's busyness and their distractedness. It's an inclination to do anything but the one thing that we are supposed to be doing, the one thing that God has called us to do, that one vocational task that we tend to be avoiding. Now, we began with that because, well, we're preaching about seven deadly sins. And if we go through the series and God speaks and we're convicted either about things we've been doing that we ought not be doing, namely sin, or virtue that we should be embracing in place of vice, but we hear it, we're convicted, and we think, that just sounds so tedious. I'd rather do anything else. And then we do nothing. Well, we will have wasted a lot of time, won't we? So that's where we began. I want to take a moment this morning before we talk about the next sin, the next vice, to talk a little bit about the seven deadly sins themselves. I think seven deadly sins, it's something as a concept most of us are familiar with. We've heard it, but I think a lot of people probably couldn't name the seven deadly sins if they were put on the spot. It's something that exists kind of in the background of Western culture, but we don't really do very much with it. Now, I know all of you, you're all good students of God's Word. I know you're reading it all the time, right? Nod your heads yes. Don't lie in church, but nod your heads yes. All right. And so you already know that the seven deadly sins aren't in the Bible. I mean, they're in the Bible. They're all over the place in the Bible, but there's no one verse or one passage where Paul says, you know, these are the seven bad ones, so stay away from them. So if the collection of these seven together don't come from Scripture in particular, where did they come from? You may recall last week, we talked a little bit about the desert fathers, the desert monastics. And that really is where this tradition comes from, though it has a long journey. It began with a guy named Evagrius. So if you're looking for a wonderful name for your next boy, Evagrius. And Evagrius, he lived in the 4th century, about 350 years after the time of Jesus. And Evagrius went out into the desert of Egypt. He moved into one of these communities. You remember where men would go out, they kind of live in isolation. They'd live in caves. They'd build little huts. And they were giving their life to prayer and to meditation and an attempt to spend their entire life in the presence of God. And Evagrius went and joined one of these communities outside of Alexandria, Egypt. And over the years, he was paying attention. He was paying attention to his own spiritual life, and he was paying attention to the spiritual lives of other people in the community. And as he watched, he began to discern, a number of things that were barriers, things that were hindrances, things that were difficult in this sort of life where you had committed yourself to God. And he began taking note and writing these things down. And hear me, this is a very important point that I don't want us to miss. When we're talking about the seven deadly sins, we are not talking about the sort of things that plague the world outside the walls of the church. No, no. We're talking about things that are challenges, temptations, and difficulties for people who've already committed their lives to following Jesus. These are our problems. And so that's why we're talking about it. So Evagrius, he didn't write down the seven deadly sins. In fact, his list had eight. And he didn't call them deadly sins. He used a Greek word. It means something more like evil thoughts or temptations. And these are the eight he gave us. Gluttony, lust, avarice, sadness, anger, acedia, sloth, vainglory, and pride. And this list was inherited and carried by his student, John Cashin. I believe we quoted him last week. And John Cashin was an important character because he was the one who brought this tradition to the Western church. And if you go back far enough in church history, that's actually the roots of our own tradition. So a couple centuries later, along came a guy called Gregory the Great. Gregory the Great, and he picked up this list, this kind of tradition of eight things that are difficult for people who've committed their lives to following Jesus, and he tweaked it just a little bit. It was Gregory the Great that took the list of eight and reduced it down to seven, but he did it, and he made a very important distinction. The thing he took off the list was pride, but he didn't discard it. He said, no, no. Pride, it's the worst of all. Pride is the root. He was one of the first people to notice that it seems that underneath every other type of sin is pride. It's at the very heart of it. He describes it in kind of combat sort of language. This is what he says. For the tempting vices which fight against us in invisible contest on behalf of pride, which reigns over them. Well, some of them go first like captains, others follow after the manner of the army. For when pride, the queen of sins, has fully possessed a conquered heart, she surrenders it immediately to the seven principal sins, as if to some of her generals to lay it waste. For pride is the root of all evil, but the seven principal vices, as its first offspring, no doubt spring from this poisonous root, namely vainglory, envy, anger, melancholy, avarice, gluttony, and lust. A couple things I want to point out. Maybe you heard in there, he uses both the word sin and the word vice. Are they interchangeable? Are they the same thing, or can a helpful distinction be made? I think a helpful distinction can be made. Sin is probably the broader of the category, so there's certainly a lot of overlap between the two. Sin includes things like particular instances of sin. So if I were to steal something from you, that would be a particular instance of sin. But if I'm in the habit of lying, that also is sin. It's just habitual sin. Vice, while there's a lot of overlap, speaks more to one's character. About what one's character makes more or less likely. And so, if I'm given to the vice of gluttony, it's not a guarantee that when you invite me to your Super Bowl party, I will overindulge and eat way too much, but it's probably a pretty good bet. So there is some difference between sin and vice. When you get to the Middle Ages, you find this depicted in the artwork, this idea of pride being the root of all the rest. You could find pictures drawn of what you might call sin trees. The root and the trunk were pride, and the tree would go up and it would branch out into the seven vices, what was often called the cardinal vices. And then on top of that, you'd have offshoots and branches and leaves of all the particular ways sin manifests itself. And, well, this is really what this tradition is all about. It's about getting to the heart of the problem, because I think a lot of people spend a lot of the energy and a lot of their time, well, just trimming the tree, keeping it looking presentable, dealing with this little sin here and this little sin here and this sin here, and they never actually get around to laying the axe to the root and killing it once and for all. So that's why we're talking about these things. In the Middle Ages, there was a thinker named Aquinas, and he picks up this tradition. And as he writes about it, he's trying to help us understand how exactly vice works in the human heart. And to understand how vice works, you have to understand how it relates over to virtue. In Aquinas' formulation of the Summa, that's kind of his big work, clearly reveals the goods at stake in the case of each vice. The first thing we need to understand about vice is it's always aimed at something good. A glance at the virtues, which he associates with the seven vices, yields the following conclusions. Charity is about the love of God and neighbor, while sloth and envy oppose and undercut this. Justice and generosity concern money and possessions and security, while avarice craves and pursues them excessively. Magnanimity regards honor and respect, while vainglory is the twisted pursuit of them, and temperance targets pleasures associated with eating and drinking and sexual activity, while lust and gluttony, each in their own way, seek these goods in increasing measure and for immediate self-gratification. In other words, Richard Foster's book on the three great temptations, money, sex, and power, about sums up sin for most of us. Now, here's an important thing. We need to understand this. Why would we count these seven as the main sources and most fruitful of the vices? And Aquinas explains that they aim at things that most attract human beings, the goods we most long to possess. Because each good on the list above holds a close affinity to human fulfillment, we find ourselves perennially tempted to substitute them for true fulfillment as the goal of our lives. The vices offer subtle and deceptive imitations of the fullness of human good, which we often simply call happiness. Lust offers pleasure, avarice promises self-sufficiency, envy and vainglory offer to secure our worth and approval, sloth beckons with comfort, wrath clings to control, pride prizes status, superiority, and power. In the words of one contemporary author, the simplest definition of an addiction is anything we use to fill the empty place inside us that belongs to God alone. This is what you need to understand about vice. It's always a counterfeit. Virtue is hard work. Virtue takes effort. Virtue, well, takes patience to get there because it develops over the long course of a life. But the promise is that there are genuine goods to be had at the end of virtue. Vice comes along and says, I can get you there without the work. You can have all the good that you think will make you happy, and it won't be hard. But it's always a lie, and it always leaves you emptied out. And so you have to stay busy, and you have to stay distracted, and you have to keep buying into vice, because the last thing you want to do is discover there's a hole in your heart the size of God and you've never yet been able to fill it, try as you might. So now I've got some good news and some bad news for you this morning. And the bad news is the rest of the sermon won't apply to any of you. I'm really sorry. The good news is it will apply to somebody you know. And so what I do want you to do is stay engaged. Take really good notes, even if it doesn't apply to you. Now, what we're going to talk about this morning is pride and vainglory. You say, why would you say that? Well, There's a wonderful quote by Steve Deneff. By the way, there are two books laying in the back on the table. That's my reading recommendation. If you're looking to take up a practice for Lent, two books. One is about twice as long as the other one. So if you want the short one, read Steve Deneff. If you want the longer, more in-depth one, it's really quite excellent. Read Rebecca DeYoung, but those are back there. This is a quote from Steve Deneff about pride. Of all the sins, pride alone has the dubious advantage of making everyone sick except the one who has it. How else could an evil that provides so little pleasure have lasted, indeed flourished, as long as pride? It's because the only one who can name it can't even see it. To them, it's always something noble. Pride wears as its self-defense a shiny armor that not only makes the one inside too confident, but easily deflects any attempt to confront it. It's impervious to everything from the outside. You've noticed this. When you first see it in someone else, you dare not say anything. You cannot preach to it, pray with it, or even mention it at all. It just will not listen. Indeed, it cannot. For pride is deafness of the soul. So I know this doesn't apply to you, but take good notes. It applies to somebody you know. What does pride look like? Well, there's a lot of symptoms to pride. Some of them are pretty obvious. You know these already. The person who likes to brag, the person who likes to boast, the person who's always happy to tell you how great they are, about their exploits, how wonderful their life is, how perfect their vacation was, how great their kids are. They're the ones who are always name-dropping. I mean, it doesn't matter who they're going to name-drop somebody. Marginal importance, seen at a distance, they're going to tell you about it. They're always the hero of their story. They're more than happy to recount in painful detail some argument they had with somebody who ought to be important, and the end of the story is always the same. I sure told them. Those are the easy ones to identify, but pride can be much more subtle. How about fault finding? Are any of us really good at finding other people's faults? Are any of us well skilled in identifying the shortcomings in other people's lives and work and attitude? I'll confess, I find it very easy to be the critic. Might be a problem with pride. What about defensiveness? What about when somebody comes to you and points out one of your faults? They find fault in you. How do you respond? Somebody comes to you and says, hey, you're wrong. No, not me. Mm-mm. Do you get defensive? Do you have an inordinate need for recognition? I mean, if you could do some great thing but nobody would notice, would you be bothered to do it? What if you gave a nice and thoughtful gift to somebody and they didn't even acknowledge it? How upset would you be? Do you need that recognition, or is the thing you did good enough on its own? When Amanda and I were living in Kentucky, I had the great misfortune of sharing a name with another man. We were both named RJ. His name was RJ Corman, and RJ Corman, unfortunately, was an incredibly wealthy man. I say unfortunately for my sake, because every time I met somebody and they say, oh, I'm so-and-so, I'd say, oh, my name's RJ, and they'd be like, oh, RJ Corman, ha, 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 and that got so old for 3 years. And the reason everybody knew this man was because he had an inordinate need for recognition. He was one of these self-made men. The way the legend goes, be it true or not, is that he started out pushing a broom in a railroad company, moved his way to the top, bought them out, began buying up lines of railroads so that every time a train went over it, he got paid. And he built this massive business where the company, they did, you've noticed in the news of late, there are lots of train wrecks all over the country. He makes a lot of money every time one of those happens. That's his business. Well, it was before he passed away. RJ Corman had a lot of money, and he owned a lot of stuff. And he put his name on everything. If there was a rail line with a bridge, his name was on the bridge. If there was a company truck, his name was on the truck. There was a hospital. I assume he gave most or all the money to build the hospital. His name was on the hospital. His name was everywhere. He really liked him some recognition. Do we? C.S. Lewis says, if you want to find out how proud you are, the easiest way is to ask yourself, how much do I dislike when other people snub me or refuse to take any notice of me? I don't like getting snubbed. Francis de Sales once noted how we put up this false humility. We'll do something for somebody, and then we'll say something like, oh, it was no big deal. Don't worry about it. Oh, it was nothing. And we say that, and we're happy to say it, probably right up into the point where they agree with us. Oh, it was nothing. Nope, it wasn't. Oh, hey now. False humility. How about a reluctance to serve? Are there jobs and positions of service that are beneath you? You remember that Jesus instructed us to wash other people's feet. It's funny, that's the one passage in the whole Bible we're not real keen on taking literally. You notice this? Have you done it? Have you ever washed somebody's feet? What would you do if your pastor called you one day and said, you know, Barb's out of town for a little bit. By the way, if you guys don't know, the reason the church is always immaculately clean is Barb Buller does the cleaning. It's a wonderful job, but what if your pastor called you and said, you know, Barb's out of town. We need somebody to come and clean the bathrooms and scrub the toilets. Who's volunteering? How well do you receive advice? And in particular, I mean the unsolicited kind. When somebody comes to you with that free advice that you're getting what you paid for, how well do you receive it? Do you actually look at other people as having insights potentially into your life that you wouldn't otherwise have? Are you receptive to it? Or when somebody comes and says, hey, I know. Do you have all the answers for your life? I mean, I'm not talking about you guys. We're talking about other people. You know, it's a spiritual problem, right? Jesus tells us about this. He tells the story of the Pharisee and the tax collector praying in the temple. The Pharisee's prayer is like, well, God, I'm really glad I'm not like that sinner over there. The tax collector won't even look to heaven. He just beats his chest. And Jesus says, which one went away justified? I got to be honest. I've met a lot of Christians, not you guys, other Christians, that they come off as having the religion thing real figured out. And there is that clean, neat divide between all the people in the world who are doing it wrong and us good Christians who've got it figured out. In the spiritual life, how many of us are content to always be beginners? And to take that posture? To live out the rest of our life saying, you know what? I still don't have this figured out. I still have a lot to learn. And not as an excuse for not trying. Not like, well, I'll always be a beginner, so why work hard at it? No, I'm a beginner. I need to work extra hard at it. And there's a lot I have to learn, and I got to go find people who can teach me. Are we content to always be beginners and actually take that posture? I know a number of you have been involved in discipleship bands, and one of the rhythms in a discipleship band is the rhythm of confession. So every week you get together, and one of the questions that might be asked is, what sins have you committed since our last get-together? I'm curious how many of you, when you confess sin, dress it up a little bit. I mean, it's not that you're not telling what you did, but you're also sure to, Will you say it in a way that makes it sound a little less bad? Takes the edge off of it, you know? I mean, you confess sin, but you make sure that you give all the mitigating circumstances, like, well, I was wrong and I shouldn't have done that, but everybody understands why I did it. Been there. I've been doing the confession thing a long time. Been there, done that. And maybe you haven't ever confessed sin to somebody. I would recommend you read the book of James, but that's a different sermon. But I would hope as a Christian you've been in the practice of apologizing. Do we go to people and just say, I was wrong? No qualifications. Not, I was wrong, but I was wrong, and so, no. I was wrong. I repent. Will you forgive me? No strings attached. Do we find it hard to say, I was wrong? Bride? How many of us have trouble asking for help? Are we getting a little too close to home here? Is it? We're going to keep going, but how many of us have trouble asking for help? Might be pride. Have you ever met somebody whose life circumstances are less fortunate than your own? And you probably would never say this out loud. You're all too polite. But the thought that runs through your head is, they're probably that way because of the decisions that they made. And my life is better because I've made better decisions, which is a subtle way of saying I'm a better person. Pride. This one. I don't feel bad making you guys feel convicted because I feel convicted, okay? This has been like a lifelong struggle for me. Anybody else struggle to submit to authority? Anybody really struggle to submit to authority when you perceive the authority over you as being incompetent? Are any of us amazed at how many people we run into on a daily basis that we think are less competent than ourselves? I mean, man, it's like all of them, isn't it? I mean, you're just surrounded by incompetence everywhere we go. You're driving down the road, and everybody who goes slower than you is driving like a grandma, and everybody who goes faster is a maniac. It's uncanny. Might be pride. Might be pride. We said we're going to talk about both pride and vainglory. Vainglory is another one of these old words. We don't really use it anymore, do we? Maybe another word we could use in its place in the same family is the word vanity. And pride is the root, and vanity tends to be one of the shoots, but there is an important distinction. So pride is a disordered and inordinate pursuit of excellence and greatness. Like, you really want to be the best. You want to be great. And vainglory, properly understood, is a disordered and inordinate pursuit of recognition and approval. And in most of our lives, these two are intimately mingled together. Though we could think of them as opposite ends of the spectrum. A person who is completely full of pride but without any vanity really thinks they're the best. I mean, they really think they're great and they are pursuing greatness. They just don't care what any of you think because the opinion of the people beneath them is below them. They don't care. That would be pure pride with no vanity. On the other end of the spectrum, you have the person who is completely vain but without any pride. And that's problematic too. They don't even have enough pride to have dignity. All they want is approval and affirmation. And if they can't get approval, they'll settle for something else, like attention. And this is like most of the internet now. It's people that are so desperate to be seen, they're ready to do anything. And so in all sorts of ways, they are willing to shamelessly, in the fullest sense of the word, expose themselves, body and soul, for just a moment of attention. for a few more likes, for a few more clicks. And what they discover in the end is that they're left profoundly empty and alone after the fact. But for most of us, we live life in the middle. That is, we do want to be great. We do want to pursue excellence. We want to be noticed. We want to be recognized. We wanted to be approved of. And what I hope you heard as I was defining those terms is that these are a disordered, inordinate pursuit of things that otherwise might be good. Because the truth is, God has made all of us with an inborn need for recognition and approval. That is, we want to be known as we are, and we want to be approved of as we are. We all have a real need for self-esteem. The problem is, where are we going to go get it? You also were made with a need for glory. But again, the question is, where are you going to go to get it? The Apostle Paul gives us a wonderful answer in Romans chapter 8. So then, brothers, we're debtors not to the flesh, to live according to the flesh. For if you live according to the flesh, you will die. But if you live by the Spirit, you put to death the deeds of the body, you will live. For all who are led by the Spirit of God are sons of God. Did you hear it? I mean, it's a church, so all y'all, in theory, should be Spirit-led people. And if you're led by the Spirit, you are children of God. Think about it as a parent. I mean, what is more important to a parent than their precious child? It is of immense value. You can't put a price on it. It's an incredible value. How much more for the God who loves you? The challenge is, that's a hard story to live by. Because you grew up and you were given stories about what you were worth. I don't know where you heard them. Maybe it was on the playground. Maybe it was all the children around you told you that, well, you're dumb. You're ugly. You're slow. You're not very interesting. Maybe it was at home. Maybe it was a parent who told you, you're never going to become anything. You're lazy. You're good for nothing. And we've heard these stories so long. We just take them and we internalize them and we begin to live with them. And because we need that self-esteem, we're just looking for it anywhere. All of a sudden, this temptation of pride and of vainglory, an easy path to get the thing that we crave, it becomes really tempting because we've been told these stories, but what we really need is a better story. We need to hear and internalize and begin to live a story where God tells you who you are, where God tells you what you're worth. And all who are led by the Spirit are children of God, for you did not receive the spirit of slavery to fall back into fear, but you have received the spirit of adoption as sons, by whom we cry, Abba, Father. The Spirit Himself bears witness with our spirit that we are children of God. How do we learn to live out a different story? You have to spend time in the Spirit, because it's the Spirit who will tell you who you are. And you need His Spirit to witness to your spirit that you are God's child and therefore of incredible worth and value. And if children, then heirs. You want to talk about status? I mean, if you're an heir of God, I'm just imagining you stand to inherit a lot. Yes? Heirs of God and fellow heirs with Christ, provided we suffer with Him in order that we may also be glorified with Him. It Can you imagine this? I tell you to close your eyes, but I don't want you to go to sleep. I want you to imagine the glory Christ will have at the end of days. The trumpet sounds, Christ returns. All of creation is judged, and then creation is made new. And the dwelling of God is with man. And we are raised to new everlasting bodily life, and all that was dirty and broken and vile is washed away. And it's the world the way God intended it. And Christ sits on an eternal throne. And his glory is such that the writer of Revelation says, we won't need a sun. He's got that much glory. That's the glory you were meant to share in. That's an awful lot of greatness. But it has to be pursued in the right way. Provided we suffer with him, in order that we may also be glorified with him. For I consider that the sufferings of this present time are not worth comparing with the glory that is to be revealed to us. I wonder if Paul had in the back of his mind when he talks about suffering, not just the sort of suffering that some other person might inflict on us, but the sort of strenuous work that over a course of a life develops virtue and the character of Christ, so that when he returns, we're ready and fit for the glory we were always made for. Don't settle for the sham, for the false substitute that doesn't satisfy. Don't settle for vanity or for pride. It doesn't satisfy. Well, what do we do about that? Because I imagine this is actually a problem for all of us, whether we've seen it in ourselves yet or not. We would imagine that, well, the opposite of pride is humility. But you really just don't flip a switch, do you? And stop acting prideful and start being humble. And again, Steve Deneff's got a wonderful quote. He says, the problem with telling a proud person to be humble, it's like telling a deaf person to listen to you. To the extent that they heard you in the first place, they're not actually deaf. And to the extent that they can't hear you, they cannot listen. And so humility really isn't like an opposite sort of behavior. It's more like a character you arrive at. But you go about getting it a different way. And I got to tell you, this isn't actually easy. So this is something Evagrius told us in the 4th century. He said, it's difficult to escape vainglory. For what you do to rid yourself of it becomes for you a new source for vainglory. So you wake up one day and you decide, you know what, I need to kill pride in my life and I'm going to take appropriate action to do it. And you do it and all of a sudden you're proud that you did it. Dang it. It's a lot harder than what it looks. That's your warning. So what might we do? What actions or habits or practices might we embrace that would help us lean into a character of humility and help kill our pride? Well, we should probably begin with the words of Jesus. That seems like a wise place to begin. Matthew chapter 6. Jesus says, beware of practicing your righteousness before other people in order to be seen by them. For then you'll have no reward from your Father who is in heaven. Thus, when you give to the needy, sound no trumpet before you as the hypocrites do in the synagogues and in the streets, that they may be praised by others. Truly I say to you, they have received their reward. But when you give to the needy, do not let your left hand know what your right hand is doing, so that your giving may be in secret. And your Father who sees in secret will reward you. You might need to begin cultivating a secret life where you try to do really, really good things and you try to make sure nobody knows about it. Maybe you start keeping a journal of all the things you did that you were able to keep secret. Well, unless that journal would become itself a source of pride and you pat yourself on the back because you're filling up the pages, maybe you just do things in secret and then forget about it. Strive to serve without recognition. This used to be a problem for the younger people. Now I think it's just a problem for all the people. Can I suggest to you that you stop putting your entire life on social media? I mean, why is it we have this instinct that if anything good happens, anything noteworthy, anything praiseworthy, we have to put it on social media so that everybody can see? If you're wondering, this is one of, not the only one, but this is one of the reasons your pastor has this many social media accounts. None. Why? Because I got enough problems with pride. I don't need to add to it. You might just need to stop putting your whole life on social media for all the world to see. You realize if you could snap your finger and pride and vanity and vainglory would go away, all of the social media companies would collapse tomorrow. Because they run on that stuff. And there's something of a feedback loop too, I think. You might need to stop putting your whole life on social media. Richard Foster, who wrote The Celebration of Disciplines, recommends silence and solitude as spiritual disciplines that will help starve our pride. He says you need to get alone with God and then stop talking. There are a number of ways that I think that can help starve out our pride. But I have to imagine that it goes back to what Paul said in Romans 8, that if we can get alone with God and get quiet, you can begin to hear the still small voice of the Spirit whisper to you who you are. You are a child of God. And if you know who you are, you don't worry about the pride stuff so much. If you know who you are, you don't have anything to prove. Silence and solitude. And if I say that and you're already squirming in your seat because you think the idea of spending extended periods of time alone and quiet, and by the way, silence and solitude does not involve your cell phone, in case you were wondering. And if that idea sounds abhorrent to you, that might be diagnostically significant. Silence and solitude. Steve Deneff offers in his book a number of things. We have to get to the place where we're constantly reminded that God is God and we are not. You were never meant to be in the center of your universe, which is exactly where pride wants to put you. Your very self cannot sustain the weight of that. That seat isn't for you. It's for God. And I have to imagine that the reason so many Christians struggle with this is that we're not in regular habits of worship. I don't know very many Christians who have a habit of worship that exists outside of Sunday morning. The problem is we need to find our way back to the place where we're on our knees and we say, you are God and I am not. I worship you, you don't worship me. You're the king of the universe. Not me. You must be the center of my life. Not me. We may need a more regular and sustained habit of worship. If we're struggling with pride, I suggest we ought to find ways to turn towards other people. To find ourselves in that place where we actually think other people are more interesting than us. That in a conversation, I'd rather hear about what's going on in your life than talk about myself. We need to turn towards others. Find our way into community. Steve recommends you find and follow a leader. Do you have somebody in your life that you've willfully submitted to and they can tell you what to do? I do. I have a number of men in my life that if they said, RJ, you need to do this, even if I didn't want to do it, I'd do it. I need that. I need that to keep me honest, but I don't think a lot of adults have that. We don't actually have leaders we're following. We don't have people, spiritual people. And you got to use wisdom and discernment to find them. Not just any person's a good person to follow. Amen? But do you have somebody in your life who can tell you what to do? Probably not a bad idea. And this is what Steve ends with. Man, this is a tough one. He says, we need to submit to the correction of the people of God. That's the church. He says, here's a tough one to swallow. Submit to the correction of God's people. Pride is a game of solitaire. Those who lose at it are usually surrounded by the company of good people. Because wisdom is never the sole possession of one, but the collective of many voices. Here's the idea. If you want to learn wisdom, find a church and get in it. Go regularly, settle in, volunteer, support and pray for the leaders, participate in its small groups or mission teams. The tendency to leave the body that is not meeting your needs and to find one that's more interesting is, in part, due to pride. The more you're surrounded by ordinary people with their flaws and contradictions and annoying little habits, the harder it will be for you to hold on to your pride. That is, so long as you really enter the body, participating, and not just going to church to watch a sermon. Glad he said it so I didn't have to. That's part of what the church is about. You see, we need each other. We need outlets and places where we can turn to others and let God sometimes speak through others into our lives. Like I said, I know this doesn't apply to any of you. Just me and some other people that you know, but I hope you took good notes. The thing about pride is you're not going to go out tomorrow and have this licked. It's a long journey. But let me encourage you to do this. I believe because the Spirit of God is here and the Spirit of God is speaking, everybody in here heard one thing. I threw a lot at you, but you heard one thing. Whatever it was you heard God say to your heart, whatever it was that convicted you, don't go home and forget that. Act on it. Whatever it was. Because the journey of 1,000 miles begins with what? One step. And dealing with pride feels like a journey of 1,000 miles. But whatever it is God put on your heart, can I encourage you to do something about it today? Before you forget, before you move on to the next week, act on it. And don't see if God doesn't do something in you.